When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary with Minky Couture, luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.
The thing that got me through was the old, like, you don't like it, you just have to do it. And how many other times in life has that helped get me through hard things?
Team Never Quit Radio.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ Podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit Podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Team Never Quit Podcast. As always, thank you guys so much for listening and watching, and please don't forget to hit that like and subscribe button wherever you're getting this show. So today, before we get to our really special guest, let's kick it off with our weekly Patreon question. And this week, we've got, what is one thing that you really learned about yourself during COVID?
I learned how, like, absolutely essential and valuable freedom is to me, because COVID, I was living in Los Angeles during COVID, and there was a point where they banned surfing. So you can go on. Yeah, I know, right? So
Marcus, I didn't know that.
You know me, right?
Yeah.
Like, I am a surfer to my core. I'm a surfer kid from Santa Cruz. My whole life in the ocean. The ocean represents freedom to me. And you want to talk about, like, government overreach and, like, not following the science. I remember reading some scientific article that said perhaps the waves could, like, stir up COVID. And it was anathema to everything I believe in life. Like, and so there's a video, you can go online and see it, of, like, a buddy of mine in Malibu paddleboarding, and, like, three government agencies, like, lifeguard boat and a helicopter and another, descend on him.
Yeah,
it went viral, right? To me, that was the quintessential example of everything that was wrong about COVID. For us, I think, Marcus, the ocean has always represented freedom. And the idea that the government could try and shut that down was just wrong.
That is so crazy that they went after him. Like, no one was around him.
Yeah, by the way, there was no safer place to be during COVID than alone by yourself in the ocean, paddleboarding in the middle of the ocean. That's how ridiculous things had gotten. And it is, like, it's one of these life lessons in not getting, like, caught up in groupthink, right?
Fear.
And making sure we think for ourselves.
It's funny how fear takes over and can do something like that.
That's right.
I think the thing for me, I learned that we don't need everything that we have. Like, our family went up to our family ranch, and we kind of created this bubble because of fear. My little sister has a heart condition, and they were like, she can't get COVID. And we had to kind of create this protective bubble around her, and which ended up being great because we had this great family time out there that was very secluded and very much a bubble of fun out there. And we love the ranch. But being out there, I realized we don't need all of the stuff that we have at home. And we started gardening. I ordered baby chicks. We started raising chickens. We had all of this stuff, and
we ended up getting hundreds of chickens.
We ended up staying out there for 9 months, and it kind of turned into Little House on the Prairie type. And I freaking loved it. I was thriving. That is where I should be in life. And I didn't want to go home. I absolutely loved it. So I think for me, I learned that I don't need all the crap that we have every day.
That's a good one. Because a grandparent, all the family was out there. Mm-hmm. So in the morning, you go to the grandparents' house for breakfast. It's called the COVID Cafe.
Yeah.
And we had different meals. They had a menu on the door that they'd tape of what he would cook.
Yeah, my grandpa would
and
make a
menu. And
then
we had a sport we would play, like baseball, softball. Everyone had to muster up at the gym. And then you just kind of rotate. I remember I was the garbage man. I took out the trash from everyone's house. So I get up in the morning and do my rotations.
I made dinners. Yeah. Everybody, so
everybody had a certain deal.
Because we have multiple houses at the ranch. It's like a huge family compound. And so it was just, it turned into the neatest thing.
How to live in the, because we were on the road so much, always gone. And when you're home, you're not really home. I remember even when we had the house, I would still have a suitcase in my closet that I pull clothes out of.
Yeah.
And I learned how to be a father and be around the kids and what that actually meant and that whole, you know, dwindled it all back down. Some people I would talk to like, man, I can't stand this, man. I'm having to be around my family all the time. And I really enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. That gave me a great understanding of what it meant to be next to your wife and your children and old school, right? Just out there in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you're right. There's two sides of the coin. Like, you know, like liquor consumption was up like, you know, 180%.
That happened
right?
Too.
Yeah. No, it was about core essentialism, right? Yeah. A lot of the bullshit in life got stripped away. And like the core essential of like family or like freedom, or even like I was in LA for part of the time, nightmare, you know, like just even working out, like the things that really, really matter to you.
And I think it depends on what access you have to things. Like we had access to just a lot of land and, you know, we were able to create our own environment, which was amazing. But people that live in apartments or, you know, something like that, that would be hellish. That would be a complete nightmare. So thankfully we didn't have to deal with
that. When you look back on it and people read about it, like our great grandkids, like, okay, so you guys shut down the gyms and all the churches, but the liquor store was open. Like, yeah, it was.
Essentialism.
Essentials, man. It's crazy, right? Did that happen?
It is. It is. I mean, honestly, there's a little scar tissue, like, because, you know, I owned a gym at the time that got shut down because of COVID. And there were, like, two Americas when it came to COVID, right?
Yeah.
There was, you know, and it, unfortunately, it kind of broke along political lines. There was red state and blue state America. I was living in California. I'm a Californian. Mm-hmm. I owned a gym in California. It got shut down. And I think that was, like, part of the overreach and the stuff that really like people felt was the lunacy of the overreach around COVID was like, here's a crisis that is about health and you're shutting down wellness, right? And there's all kinds of reasons, there's all kinds of misinformation, but fundamentally, like we wanted people to be healthy. My sister's an ER physician, as you know, Marcus, and like, you know, the one overriding lesson for her from COVID was healthy in equals healthy out. If you came in with COVID and you were already like not a healthy person, you're in bad shape, you know? And here I thought I owned a gym with another frogman, Carter Gaffney, right? And thought like, you know, here we are like building the prophylaxis against, you know, bad outcomes from COVID by getting people healthy, and the gym got shut down, and that's when you knew things were really bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's crazy how the mindset of the government at that time.
I tell you, to my amazement, though, it was, you can see how fast Americans can react. They shut us down overnight, locked everybody down.
Yeah.
And then we slowly kind of figured out ways to reconnect with each other, just like anything that grows. But
it was all based on fear, which is how governments do control people. Like, they're like, everyone's going to die if you don't do this. It was this huge fear-based shutdown.
Yeah, that was a tough one then. That's a good question. What about
Hunter,
you?
Hunter, what did you learn?
Hunter was like three at the time, you know?
Hunter was in his senior...
He had the best time of his freaking life.
Yeah, I had such a great time. I mean, for the first part of it, it was still in Baton Rouge, and it just became a big hangout sesh.
Like LSU shut down, but everybody still hung out and created their own pods.
Yeah, one long spring break for him.
And then it eventually moved down to the ranch, and I feel like at that time, creativity really peaked, doing the pictures with the giraffes, homework, making little vlogs out, just daily stuff, getting outside, and I mean, I was probably outside 95% of the day. Yeah, so
you were so tan.
Yeah, I got a picture of him. He set this table up out in the middle of the pastures, and he's got his school books out, and he's doing homework, and the giraffes are around him. And I mean,
our family had a ranch. Part of our ranch had giraffes on it. So, and they would free roam.
Zebra. And yeah. Yeah, it was the craziest thing, man.
Yeah.
It was great. Yeah, I don't want to hear anything out of him, man. He had a blast.
Yeah.
I definitely saw where creativity could kind of peak there and just getting outside doing things that you wanted to do.
And you went hog hunting and all that.
Everything.
Yeah.
Two Americas. I was not living with giraffes and zebras.
Well, yeah, we had a very different experience just because of our family's access to the ranch, but it was really neat.
That's cool. Good question. All right, my brother.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming on here.
It's so good to see you guys. Taj
Larson. The way we do this, man, I want to introduce you a little bit of your backstory before we get into the meat of it, and kind of like where you came from, what you're all about, how you got into the SEAL teams and whatnot, and then how we met, and then we'll just go from there. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
So you kind of got into a little bit. You're a California boy by birth.
Yep.
All right, now go.
Yep. So born and raised in Santa Cruz, California, and Santa Cruz it's kind of like a sleepy surfer hippie town in Northern California. I like to say, like, you can't graduate third grade in Santa Cruz if you don't surf. My like closest friend growing up in eighth grade was this guy, Jay Moriarty. He ended up passing away, but he surfed Mavericks when we were 16. Mavericks is this big wave up in NorCal that was like a secret among my friends growing up who surfed on the west side. We all surfed this place called Steamer's Lane. And then that was kind of the proving ground. If you could surf Big Middle Peak at Steamers, then you could go up to Mavs. Jay was the first from like my friend set to go surf this secret wave up north. Eventually in like 92 or something, it got revealed to the world.
That was going
to
be my question.
Yeah.
It's like, y'all kept that a secret for a while. Then documentary Mavericks came out. I remember watching that.
Yeah. Yeah, and the movie too, Chasing Mavericks.
Chasing Mavericks, yeah.
About Jay's life, yeah. So, you know, I grew up in that. I was an ocean lifeguard, competitive ocean lifeguard. I used to compete. And for us, ocean lifeguard, it's not like at a pool with a whistle. It was all the best watermen. And being like a great waterman was really like something to aspire to. And I had all of these mentors who were big wave surfers and competitive lifesavers. In Australia, surf lifesaving is an actual sport within itself. And the lifeguards are famous the way our NBA basketball players are famous because they compete in these different surf lifesaving clubs. I was one of the few Americans who was sort of competing on that competitive circuit along with guys like Craig Hummer and Anthony Vela. These are old school lifeguards. So I grew up in that culture where being a great waterman was kind of the zenith. I was playing water polo in high school, and then I was ultimately recruited to go to the Naval Academy and play water polo. And so that kind of, those were the first early stage inklings of my frogman journey.
I didn't realize you went to the Naval Academy.
Well, that's because I didn't graduate.
Oh.
That's another reason why I made it through Bud so good, because they found out about that. I'm like, you're in.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. They love me.
Yeah,
they
anybody love gets me. Kicked out of the academy and then shows back up.
That's exactly.
That's a good one. Okay, so, but there's a little hidden, another lifestyle that came out of Santa Cruz is the skates population. Do you guys interact with them at all?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, you know, Santa Cruz now is different, right? And it's different now because of, frankly, Silicon Valley. You know, it's the only real surf destination. Cold water, a lot of men in gray suits, i.e. big sharks, and stuff. But it was really like my mom taught at the university. I grew up on the faculty apartments of this beautiful university campus. But Santa Cruz was like sleepy and rural. But then with the advent of Silicon Valley, it was the closest beach community proximate to Silicon Valley. So there's this like big wealth effect and stuff. But in my day, Santa Cruz was like you said, surfers, skaters, even some gangsters. And that was kind of the mix of people that were there.
So how'd you even come up with the Navy idea?
Probably not that dissimilar from a lot of other Navy guys. Top Gun, all right?
It did it. Tom Cruise, man.
Right?
Dude,
yeah.
Guy is a great recruiter.
Yeah. We wanted to go, you know, 1,000 miles an hour with my hair on fire, right? Like all that stuff. I watched Top Gun. I started flying early. My dad got me started in flying lessons when I was 11 years old. I used to fly like Cessna 152s and 172s out of Watsonville Airport, which is close to my hometown. And so I had that love of aviation and flying, and watched Top Gun And, you know, that's it. I wanted to be a naval aviator, just like Tom Cruise. Applied to the Naval Academy, recruited because of water polo. And I had never even heard of SEALs when I went to the Naval Academy. This is, you know.
Really?
Yeah. No, this is, you know, I graduated high school in 95. Yeah. And I showed up at the Naval Academy at 17. And then I'm playing water polo. And I looked back one year at my freshman and sophomore year water polo photo from the Naval Academy. And something like, I don't know, maybe of the 21 guys, something like 11 or 12, over half had gone Naval Special Warfare. So you had all these legendary frogmen like Tommy Donovan, now Admiral.
Yeah.
Donovan was our team captain and stuff. And they started telling me about this SEAL thing.
How about that for us being old?
Yeah.
All our guys are admirals now.
It was, yeah. No books, no movies, right? Like, are SEALs? What are SEALs? You know?
And it was still pretty close to the chest back then, man.
Yeah.
The Vietnam guys didn't talk about it, so we didn't really. There was Navy SEALs with Charlie Sheen.
But back then it was all Delta Force. Yeah, everybody was Chuck Norris and Delta Force. Yeah.
Commando. All those guys were SF dudes.
That's right. That's right.
100%.
So yeah. Why did you not graduate?
Basically, I hated it. I hated the Naval Academy. I thought I was going there like to fly, and then I'm like stuck in a uniform, marching around with a rifle. And there was just like a whole bunch of reasons. I was young. I was I missed home. I missed surfing. I would sneak off campus and like take my car. I had a sailboat off campus, you know, and a car off campus, which you weren't supposed to do. So sometimes I would like swim. I'd like jump in the river and I'd swim to get around what we called the Jimmy Legs, like the security patrol. Then I'd drive my car to Ocean City, Maryland and surf. And I was just like, this is not the experience that I signed up for. So, and then I picked up another water polo scholarship. And so I transferred schools and ended up back in my hometown in Santa Cruz, playing water polo, doing competitive surf lifesaving. I didn't know if I was going to surf competitively, if I was going to join that professional ocean surf racing circuit. So I graduated from UC Santa Cruz. But what was interesting then, and I thought maybe I'd go to Europe and play water polo professionally. I was in that sort of what I call postgraduate distress disorder.
Yeah.
But I had never, I still had this, like the same reasons, like the real reasons that I had joined the Navy in the beginning. You know, my grandfather served in the Navy band in World War II. My father, U.S. Marine Corps, Parris Island Marine. All of the real core fundamental reasons that I had joined in the first place were still there. And then all my friends were heading off to SEAL training, off to BUDS. So like the summer before, so here I am in Santa Cruz, and then they would come out and see me like on their way to Coronado. They'd be like, oh, let's stop and see Kaj in Santa Cruz. So, you know, Eric Ulrich.
Great freaking guy, man.
Before he started BUDS Class 228.
Yeah.
Stops in Santa Cruz to surf with me. I take him out to my home break, and he's on his way to BUDS. And so all my friends now from polo and from the academy, you know, my squad at the academy, the squad leader was Mike Martin, who became my platoon commander at SEAL Team 1.
Yeah.
Right?
Love that dude.
Yeah. The second class was Walt Allman, Admiral Allman.
Best SEAL ever to come down the pike.
Waldo, right?
Walt and Teresa are like my favorite
people on planet.
Family, like, unit. I
should be the original human.
Love them.
That was my second class in my squad at the Naval Academy. My squad at the Naval Academy was Mike Martin, Walt Allman, Kaj Larson, and Eric Ulrich, and then one other guy who actually ended up lat transferring and not making it through. So we were like frogman deep at the academy.
Ulrich is a whitefish boy.
Oh yeah,
freaking up north,
him
man.
And Zinke,
they got
right?
something in the water up there too, because there's a few of them guys.
Yeah, him and Zinke are the OG whitefish frogmen, right?
Beaming.
Yeah.
All them dudes, man.
Yeah.
There's something about Montana boys too, man.
Yeah. So I watched all my friends like coming down, going through BUDS. I watched Ole go through BUDS with you. And I still had that pulsing desire to serve. So I actually applied to go back in through OCS. So, and then I got a billet and got commissioned through OCS.
Dude, I don't know if that's lucky or unlucky.
Actually, okay. Like at the risk of like, the risk of going too long, the risk of talking too much. Like, I mean, the real story is even crazier. So I apply to go to OCS, and basically everybody was asking what you're asking, Melanie, like the leadership, like the selection, the officer community manager at the time, you know, the board that meets to evaluate candidates is like, this guy was at the Naval Academy and he left, like, doesn't quite track, right? Like, we're just going to pass. Because at the time, you know, SEAL billets for SEAL officers out of the academy, now they get like 20 or 30 billets. At the time, they only had like 15. And they balance them between Naval Academy, OCS, and ROTC. Get a proportionally about the same number of billets. So that meant at the time, OCS billets for SEAL officers across the country were about somewhere between 10 and 12.
12,
billets.
Right? Yeah, yeah, 10, 12.
Exactly. And they were, and they're managed by the officer community manager. So I was competing for one of 12 billets across the entire country for people who had just graduated college on their own. ROTC, same thing. They're competing against the ROTC kids, and Naval Academy competing against that. You know, there's a two-track, you know, path to buds, right? Obviously, if you're enlisted, sometimes they use the big funnel approach. That's why they got that funny guy, like, so you want to come be a frogman, yeah, yeah, right? But for officers, there's so few billets that it's highly, highly competitive just to get one of those billets. And here I had a black mark against me, perceived black mark, because I'd already been at the Naval Academy. So I actually got passed over. So I applied and they said no to my application. And then while all this was going on, I was lifeguarding in Santa Cruz. And you've never been there, right, Marcus or Melanie? No. You guys haven't been to Santa Cruz? Mm-hmm. Got to get you there sometime. My dad would love to see you guys. Beautiful place, Monterey Bay. There's a pier that goes out into the ocean right on the beach that I was lifeguarding. And this, I was sitting there on the beach and I saw the lifeguard vehicle driving code 3 on the beach. And it, which it never does, which lights and sirens because dangerous, little kids running around stuff. And they drive up to me and they're like, a car just drove off the end of the wharf. Go. So I run
up. Off the bridge?
What?
Off the bridge?
No, off a pier that goes out like a mile into the ocean.
Like off of that.
Off of that. And I was like, holy shit. So I run out there with a bunch of other lifeguards, and there's this big section of railing missing, and I start diving down to the car. And at first, I couldn't make it, and none of the other lifeguards could really make it down. And eventually, I was able to make it down into the car, and I got myself into the car, and I was like, there was a guy trapped in the car. It was on its back like a turtle. And
on
I
the
did,
bottom?
What? Yeah, on the bottom, bottom of the ocean, like 40 feet deep. And Santa Cruz is cold. Water is cold year-round because we have this 5,000-foot trench called the Monterey Canyon, which super cools the water. So the water is like, you know, 50 degrees, silky, really poor visibility. Only a couple of us who were like the top ocean lifeguards at that time could make it down into the car. And me and this guy, Ryan Buell, were like the only ones who actually made it inside the car. Eventually, we were able to like swivel this guy around, and with the help of a dive team, I remember the first dive I made where I got my hands on him, I put my feet against the side of the car as I was pulling him from the outside, and I heard his whole shoulder rip. But he wouldn't come out because the roof was so smashed. Right?
I got his arm. I'll go back and get the rest
yeah,
of him.
Yeah, exactly. Like, right, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was like that. Eventually, we were able to like swivel him around, bring him out feet first, like a breech berth, and we got him out.
Was he big? Was it a big fat guy? Or
no, he okay, wasn't. Good. It was.
I figured because you're like that, have been a big old huge freaking.
No, it was crazy. You know, it's a tragic story. He ended up not making it.
Oh, shit.
Right, he had just flown over from UK. He was like 21 years old. Was like confused about driving on the wrong side of the street, and when he pulled into the parking spot at the end of the wharf, he hit the gas instead of the brakes, and the car leapt off the edge of the wharf. It was insane. And it was middle of summer, and people are like, I remember I'd come up for air. It took us about 11 minutes to get him out of the car, which is too long. Yeah. Even in that, water's cold, but not that cold.
Yeah.
Right. Too much brain infarction. And so, but I remember I'd come up and like, I'd be like doing a breathe up before I did another drop down, and people would be like, he's down there. Go get him. Yeah, scream at me like, why don't you jump in the ocean and try this? But anyways, a couple of us were honored with like the equivalent of like a key to the city, an exceptional citizen award for the rescue and for our efforts that day. And here's the part that relates back to the SEAL teams that's kind of crazy, is Commander Tom Carlson at the time was the officer community manager. And he was on vacation with his wife in San Francisco. They drive down to Santa Cruz just to have a vacation day to get like some clam chowder on the wharf, and there's like a plaque detailing the rescue, and Tom Carlson is like, I kind of know this story. I've heard it because I had submitted it with my application, but something about like looking there, looking down at the water, seeing the water, like made him realize. He's like, you know what? I think this guy, and he asked one of the workers, like, and you know, luckily one of the workers, like, oh yeah, that guy Kajarsi is a stud. He was diving down there. He was like, basically ripped that guy's arm off trying to get him out. And Tom just had this like, I don't know about epiphany, but he just had this feeling.
That's how you got
this gut instinct. And so that year they opened up 13 billets instead of 12.
13th warrior.
Yeah,
hey, exactly. Good for you, man. That alternate in there.
Six man off the bench.
Yeah, what's up? Good for you, man.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
That's awesome.
Because it's not like in the movies. And every now and again when I'm watching TV and I see somebody go underwater on TV, I was like, I'm going to hold my breath with them, see how long. And you know they're just down there swimming around and everything's everything. It's hard. Especially if you've been running before you jump in and try to go down.
My heart rate was probably 170. Ugh. You know, and like, you know, I'm a pretty decent free diver now. I wasn't like a well-trained free diver like I was then. I was basically just going on like water polo to the bottom, you know, as if I was fighting somebody for, you know.
You got to practice that.
Yeah.
You got to practice.
Free diving is an art. It's an art, man. Yeah. It's a sport.
I got a lot of respect for those dudes.
Crazy.
So did you go in 237?
Yeah, so yeah, straight into 237. And one of the first people I actually met was Morgan, because like I had known about Marcus through Oli, through this mutual friend of ours who was, you guys were swim buddies at some point? Or?
Yeah, we were buzz together.
Yeah.
Third phase is when they patched us up. Tyler Black is my swim buddy, but anytime we were doing patrol, I got full minute. Yeah, I had Clint Burke, Billy Gallagher, you know, I had a lineup. My class was stacked, what was left of us, right?
Yeah.
And he's one of the only, all of them are the only reason I made it through Buds.
Yeah.
Like, he would help me on the runs. I was all broken up. Him and JB pulled me through all that.
Really?
Yep.
Yeah. So, Oli was one of my closest friends at the academy. We had trained together. We had prepped with this idea of being SEALs together.
He's a stud.
Because it took me another year when I transferred to graduate college. He was a year ahead of me, went through Buds with Marcus. So, I knew all about Marcus. And then I show up. And there's this other guy with Latrell on his shirt. And I was like, okay, all right, we're going to be buddies. You know, and we were swim buddies at one point, too. Although they never let Morgan and I really swim together, because Morgan was pretty fast. I was real fast.
He could run his ass off, too.
Yeah, he was in great shape. But I think Morgan and I did like two swims together. And we were like so far ahead of everybody else. They're like, okay, you guys aren't swimming together anymore. Yeah.
That's what happened to us.
Yeah.
If you're too good, they'll back you back down to some of the guys to even out the...
Yeah,
which I get.
So you were in Buds with Matt Axelson as well.
Yeah, so Ax was in my platoon. Both Ax and you know, some they break you down into platoons, right? And we started with 8 officers in our class, and we graduated 4 officers. So like a 50% attrition, which was I think at that time was pretty standard. Nowadays, it's so different. Like, people have so much more knowledge and preparation going in than we did when Marcus or when Morgan and I went in.
Well, there's a lot of emphasis on getting them in shape and keeping them there too, in the way they keep them healthy and whatnot. For sure.
I agree. Like, the physical thing is one thing, but I mean, wouldn't you agree that now people are also mentally prepared in
it's completely different.
Fundamentally different way?
Completely different.
Yeah.
They've been paying attention. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I mean, it was just different when we went through.
It's just different. Yep. It's just different. So our officer attrition rate was 50%, which was pretty standard then. So we had 8 officers. We started with 4. We eventually were broken down into 4 platoons. I was in charge of 1. And within my platoon was Axelson and James, actually, both. Within Eric Greitens' platoon was Morgan was in Eric Greitens' platoon in Buds and stuff. So, yeah. So I love Matt. I'm super close with his family still.
Yeah.
You know, Donna, Corky.
We love them.
Yeah. They're,
it's hard not to be.
Yeah.
and
Cindy obviously is like getting.
So can you see the accent? It's like a mom and dad.
It is.
You know, when they walk in, like, you have been a mom and dad, probably a grandparent.
Yeah. And the other thing, Matt and I were instantly close. Ax and I were super close because, he's from Cupertino, which is just over the hill from me. So, many, many years, both on Memorial Day or Veterans Day, they've held events. There's a statue for Matt and James in their hometown, and I have spoken at that many, many times.
California boys are easy to get along with once you kind of break past the barrier that we put up, I guess, against California people.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? It's just like this whole thing you think about, but it's not, y'all aren't like that at all, actually.
I mean, that's what we say about you Texas boys. Man, you know?
Matt was, he's a freaking great dude, man. I mean, I saw him pissed off one time in my entire life.
Oh, yeah.
That's when Morgan signed him up for sniper school, or SEER, signed him up for SEER school right after sniper school. It's a hilarious story. He's in his locker doing some work, and they'd just gotten back from sniper school, which you know is terrible. And he goes, I got some good news, man. I just signed us up for SEER school. And he was pissed. I mean, like leaving the week later. And I'll never forget that. That was a good one. My brother hooked him up on that one. Great freaking dude, man.
This episode is brought to you by Prize Picks, and I've got to say, I've been having an absolute blast using this app. You and I make decisions every day, but on Prize Picks, being right can actually get you paid. I've already went ahead and made my picks for this week's football games. I've got to say, I am feeling very confident. The app's super clean, it's fun, and honestly, you can lock in your lineup in under a minute super quick. I took Josh Allen for more than 270 passing yards, and I'm definitely looking at Saquon Barkley more than one rushing touchdown. Go check out the app because those projections change every week, but man, I've got to say, it just makes watching these games way more exciting. What I love is how easy it is. Just pick more or less on 2 to 6 player stat projections, and if you get your picks right, you can cash it in. It works in over 40 states, including Texas, California, and Georgia, and the payouts are very fast, safe, and secure. And here's something cool too. If one of your players gets injured in the first half and does not return, PrizePicks will protect your pick. I think that's pretty legit. Go download the app and use the code TNQ to get $50 in lineups after you play your first $5 lineup. That is code TNQ to get $50 in lineups after you play your first $5 lineup. PrizePicks, it's good to be right.
So crazy. I miss Axe all the time. And you know, when I first showed up for 237, the way the class systems work is kind of funny, because there's like a delay and like you're waiting to class up and stuff. So when I first showed up, like my very first couple of days over in 618, 236, the previous class hadn't classed up. So they threw me in this 4-man room with a bunch of officers, and Murph was my roommate in when I first got to Buds. He was the first person I met at Buds before I found Morgan, before I found Greitens, all these guys. So it was me, Murph, his tri bike in the room, you know, and two other random officers, one from 3-6 and one from my class, 3-7.
Oh wow.
It was pretty wild.
That's awesome.
What was the hardest part of Buds for you?
I mean, second phase was really good for me. I excelled in second phase because the water stuff.
Everybody says that's the worst.
No. But those of us with like an aquatics background, it was worse. I mean, look, I had a pretty bad night in Hell Week where I got like the silver bullet. You get the silver bullet over? No. No, it's too Texas for that. Yeah. There was this one instructor that, I mean, it's hard to have the perspective now whether he didn't like me or if he was just being hard on me, or he just saw me as like a surfer boy from California, like
officer.
And people think like
you guys got special attention.
We do get special attention, and you know, it's like everything else. Like two things can be true at the same time. There can be advantages to going through as an officer, and then also heavy as the head that wears the crown, there's like an extra layer of responsibility. I fundamentally believe that. It's easier to continue on and to continue the mission when you're worried about helping other people as well. I think that actually makes you stronger. So for me, like making sure that like the class was doing strong or that like people who were struggling, helping them, that actually helped get me through. But I think far and away, like one of the hardest moment for me, I don't know about the hardest part, but certainly the hardest moment for me was in Hell Week, like Wednesday night or Wednesday day or something, like 3 a.m. in the morning.
Like Steel Pier?
But no, this was like just a normal beatdown session.
Yeah.
And normal beatdown session.
Yeah.
Loud, standard, right? Standard operating beatdown session. This one instructor, Jay Moffitt, did you have
him? Of course.
Him? You had Moffitt.
I know who he is. He came here. Yeah.
He ended up being like becoming a good friend of mine.
Yep.
But he was like misting me down with a hose at like 3 a.m. And people think San Diego, like, oh, nicest weather in America. Like, shit is cold. Like, it is really cold. And I just straight hyped out, passed out, got the silver bullet. Now I heard they got all kinds of fancy tech, right? Like, you swallow a thermometer and they're monitoring you like a robot. Like, my days, you know, it was
they do that in front of the whole class.
Different orifice, right? But, you know, hey, whatever. You know, like, I was passed out. What do I know? And they actively rewarmed me. I think they said my core body temperature was like 89.2.
Oh,
so that's pretty.
That's full on, man.
That's
full on hypothermia.
Full on hypothermia.
Yeah,
and,
good for you.
And when you're that cold, they can't passively rewarm you. They have to actively rewarm you. So they had this like kind of like hot tubby kind of thing. And they clocked it. Somebody told me later on that that they got my core temperature back to 96, took like I think 17 or 18 minutes to get me rewarmed back to that. And then they handed me like for the first time like a brand new dry set of pressed camis, and I hadn't been like I'd been wet and sandy for 3 days straight at this point. It was the first time I had touched something warm. I had just been passed out and probed, right?
Oh,
and they're like, here's your clothes, like go rejoin your class in the ocean. And I was just like, man, I just don't want to get back in the ocean. Me, my whole life, the ocean was like the most important place to be. And I just like, you know, you get a little hydrophobic. And I just didn't want to do it.
I'll never forget that moment when they hand you the dry clothes for the first time and then they tell you to get back in the water.
Yeah.
And it's just like, well, I don't want to get these wet.
Right.
It's not me, you understand. It's these warm clothes. That's a real thing.
It's a real thing.
This feeling comes over you that you've never felt before.
Yeah.
We had one of our surfer guys quit after that.
Really?
Yeah. He was a full-on surfer, too, man. He was just like, you could see it in his face. Like something that he had loved his whole life turned on him.
Yeah.
It was weird.
Yeah. And I do think that those are like one of those seminal moments. Like, there are so many lessons that are foundational in the SEAL teams. The SEAL teams became the foundation for all the rest of my success in life and everything else I wanted to do. And I think that is one of those moments. Like, we have all these phrases that get you through, like you've had like Chris Cassidy, right?
Mm-hmm.
On like, yeah. So Chris always told me like, sometimes you just gotta push the I believe button, right? You're jumping out of a perfectly good airplane, push the I believe button. But at this moment, the thing that got me through was the old, like, you don't like it, you just have to do it. And how many other times in life has that helped get me through hard things? Because you have to do hard things in life and sometimes, and you're not gonna like it always, but sometimes like you just do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I started writing those down. I kept the journal through Buds, call them breaking moments, breakpoints.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like you're a badass, but every badass has a breaking moment, whether or not you find it or not, and those guide you to them.
Yeah.
And I noticed for a lot of our guys, it's similar. They all feel that one. And then the minute you go back and get in the water, then you passed. It's like you didn't break down, you broke open, right? They pull that shell off of you, and then next time you get into a hard spot, you're like, fuck, I've been through worse, man. That's how that happens.
Yeah.
Those breakpoints.
So in that moment, are you really like telling yourself that? Like, you just got to get back in. You got to get back in.
I mean, I think those are the moments that define whether you're a frogman or not. I you know, there's another like, you know, these little sayings that we have, you know, you could call them cliches, but what they really are is they're maxims. They're principles for how we live our lives because, you are like one. Sometimes your inner monologue and how you talk to yourself is the only thing that gets you through these hard moments. But, you know, we have this other one that, again, like sometimes we say these things flippantly, but they actually are our deep core values. And, you know, one of them is everybody wants to be a frogman on a sunny day.
On a sunny day,
especially
man.
Now. especially now that there's all of this attention and all of this hype and all of these accolades that are afforded to the special operations community. But that is not when you become a SEAL, right? Like, everybody only sees the commercials, the trailers, like the sizzle, right? Everybody sees you jumping out of an airplane on nods at 30,000 feet at night looking cool. Nobody sees you pre-breathing oxygen for 2 hours before that moment. Those hard moments, that's what actually defines a SEAL.
It's almost as if there's a point in maybe first phase, or even before you get to the buds, your mind's already thinking you're a frogman. It's just your body hadn't been through it yet.
Yeah, there's definitely, you got to fake it till you make it.
Yeah. Like, front loads it, and you're like, yeah, man, I got this. And the minute your body starts to have to go prove that, then those two talk to each other. So those maxims are there, but like, remember, we talked about this. You knew it was going to happen, blah, blah, blah. And you push them. Plus, it helps having your buddies around. You know, in certain situations, you look over and you see your guys, and they're all suffering.
And we talk about, you know, like, mental toughness a lot, but the contrapositive mental toughness is mental weakness, right? So how you talk to yourself and how you think about yourself and what your core identity and values are matters in those moments. It doesn't matter when I'm sitting here with like three people that I love, you know, in your comfortable leather chairs, right? It matters in the darkest, darkest moments. And you see the people who are not prepared and who are not built of that inner core and grit. They're internal monologue and their internal dialogue is the opposite. I'm so cold. I'm so tired. Like, oh, there's, or the other thing, and we learned this a little bit in SEER school when we talk about like the Stockdale paradox. They start saying like, oh, like it's so much better at home. Like, you know, everybody decides Tuesday night of Hell Week that college becomes really important to them. Like, oh, I just got to go get educated, you know? Like, that's what my family really wants.
Yeah, it's real.
Yeah.
I wonder what everyone's doing. I bet they're out.
Yeah. And so, like, when you're either talking to yourself about, like, how miserable you are and, like, this inner sense of pathos, you know, or they're fantasizing about, like, something else they could be doing. And that also defines not being a frog man, right?
You got to get rid of that.
Yeah. And, well, they get rid of themselves, right?
Yeah. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. And, but I do think, you know, now I do some motivational speaking, like as you do, and we've spoken, you know, on panels together. And so I know we share this ethos, but what you say about your friends being around you matters because I think one of, like, there's all these life lessons that are unlocked in the sand there down in Coronado. And one of them is that when people quit, and something you wouldn't really know from the outside, right, if you're observing, but when you see people quit, people rarely quit alone. They're sitting there on that berm, or they're sitting there and being surf tortured, and they're like whispering to their buddy next to them, like, this sucks, man. Let's get out of here. Right. And they like, and they run, you see them run, like not walk, run for the, here's people, they theoretically are gassed out, have no energy left. They're sprinting for that bell, like ding, ding, ding. And that all, and what that tells you is exactly what you said. You got to be careful who you surround yourself with because cowardice is contagious. But the flip side of that is also true, is that courage is contagious. And if you're surrounded by other strong men, when you're in the water there, you are less likely to quit. You're more likely to succeed in life.
Probably how gangs are formed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that pack mentality. If you get around some alphas that won't even let fear in the door, and they slip you in between them, there's nothing that won't even exist. It doesn't even exist. It goes away. And then we have those mental lockers we try to hide all that stuff in when we're around normal civilians. Because you can't be a team guy around like, hey, suck it up, buddy. You can't talk to him like that. You know what I mean?
Oh, my God. That is the hardest part about transitioning to the civilian sector. You know?
Yeah, like, dang. And just was sitting there looking at him and entertaining something. He's like, what the? And then you got to just keep that frogman contained.
I've heard you talk about this. We've talked about this a lot. There is this interesting paradox that the skills that make us successful as frogmen, that make us successful in the SEAL teams, some of those are foundational and they pave the path, they, you know, for future success. But some of those same skills can actually create headwinds in the civilian world, and they can actually serve you in in deleterious ways, in negative ways in the civilian world. So having to unlearn some of those habits in the civilian world, when I do a lot of work on like helping frogmen, you know, with their career, or helping any special operations guys, veterans, you know, transition into the civilian world. And some of those skills actually have to be unlearned, which is crazy.
Bro, I had to take Ibogaine to get that out of me. Like, I chewed on it that much.
Four times.
Right.
to get control of
it. Because he's a team guy. Not I mean, once.
Oh yeah. My God.
Yeah. I'm going to do this full throttle. Yeah. Full throttle.
I mean, that came into parenting and to be a husband and everything. You try to apply those. That's where a frogman went. And they separate us. I'm used to having at least one by me at all times. That's kind of we feed off of each other. They train. That is beaten. You suffer more in buds if you get caught without that swim buddy or if you do something by yourself. I mean, they look for that. Like rule number one, you know, after being silent is that one. And I couldn't get past that.
Never leave your swim buddy.
Dude, I couldn't get past that.
Yeah. No, and so here's kind of a sad but morbid example, but like I feel like one of the great values that you've done in your post team's career is that like you speak real truth. And like actually the truth is since I first met you, which is over 20 years ago, when you came to my bud's graduation, man, I got to hug you for the first time after having been through the misery and the mud with Morgan, you know, and hearing about you from Oli. So yeah, that was like 20 years ago, man. But I feel like you have always spoken truth, right? So like, here's a hard truth. Like not all of us transition successfully. And we've all had friends who have gone deep down the rabbit hole of addiction. And I had, one of our teammates was deep down the rabbit hole of addiction. And I was so infused with that ideology of never leave your swim buddy that I was actually making things worse for him. I was enabling him. I almost killed a guy,
yeah.
Right? He was involved in this like crazy situation with this like drug deal or whatever. And I was like, I was his wingman. I was his swim buddy. I was never going to abandon him. I almost like, you know, killed this guy. Thought he had a gun, right? Crazy, crazy situation. And that's, and so that's a pretty like morbid and dark example of how we have to like evaluate which of those principles that can keep you alive in the SEAL teams and can keep you alive downrange are not serving us in the civilian world.
Yeah, you have to know, you know, when it's healthy to step away.
Yeah, or I think all of this wisdom, one of the things that you guys do so brilliantly is you take all of this wisdom that we've learned in the teams and you help people to apply it to their everyday mm-hmm. lives. And I am forever grateful. I've been watching you do that for 400 episodes and on a bazillion speaking events now. And that never quit attitude, like your entire namesake here, that is what really defines us more than anything else. And so, yeah, in your civilian life, never quit, but that doesn't mean don't pivot. It doesn't mean that we have to run through every obstacle. Like it does mean that we can sometimes walk around the obstacle. That's an option.
That is absolutely an option, man. And remember, we didn't have any training when you got out. Yeah. Hell, I never even know I got out. You know what I mean? If we got that thing taps. That's usually what they play when you die, right? So, yeah. I mean, now it's the guys have gotten out, especially our generation. I think the war, when wartime frogs get hammered, hammers it in there a little harder. I mean, you really have to walk the walk and talk the talk, right? And when the guys rotate out, man, you got to love them because they're not giving up on it. Yeah. They don't give up on the mentality. You can see it in them. You're like, man, I freaking love you for that. But like, we're not quitting. We're just rotating. It's a different school.
That's right.
However you want to explain it, man. It's like, hey, different skill set.
Yeah. Yeah. We're just shifting fire.
Shifting fire, man. Yeah. Thank you. I got an out. Here we go. Here's a door. Freaking let's use this, man.
Yeah. And it's also possible to like overstress certain principles and forget about some of the other fundamental tenets we have. Like, yeah, never quit. That is true. Frogmen never quit. That's what makes us who we are. But it is also true that we have contingency planning. Yeah. We in the SEAL teams, right? So everybody likes to talk about never quitting and running through walls, right? But also, like, one of the things that defines us and makes us distinct as operators is that we have extraordinary contingency planning in the teams. Every mission has secondary and tertiary courses of action, and we have contingency planning for when things go awry. And so you should also have contingency planning in your own life. Like, okay, this business is not working out. Here's my contingency plan. Here's my second course of action that I can I can go to. So it's remembering the totality of what we learned in the SEAL teams and not just like one or two of the maxims.
Yeah, that's true.
I remember after the wars, we'd been going on for a while, we got separated. We'd see each other here and there. And I don't remember where I was when I turned on the TV, but you were on CNN getting waterboarded?
Yeah. I like to say, Marcus, like, well, you and I...
I'll never forget that. Matter of fact, I think I called Mojo. I was like, hey, man, you talked to Kaj lately? He's like, no, not in a while. I was like, I'm looking at him right now, man. He's on TV getting waterboarded.
Yeah.
Which was awesome, by the way. Great job.
Wasn't enough in SEER school, you know? Had to go back for more. Never quit. Yeah. it's so funny. God, like, even being here is so emotional. Like, seeing you, like, so much of my life has been formed by our friendship and my friendship with Morgan. But I took like a funny path, like, post teams when I rotated off of active duty. I was on my way to graduate school, and I was in this funny position because I had gone to the Naval Academy, so I wasn't eligible for the Montgomery GI Bill, which was the GI Bill at that time. Now we have the new GI Bill, which is phenomenal and excellent, and I encourage all veterans to max out their educational benefits.
Period. Make sure you do that.
Full stop. Going to graduate school is the best thing I can do.
Get it done.
Get it done. Or pass it to your children, right? Like, these are that is one of the best pieces of legislation that's ever been passed.
Right? That vet card, the vet ID you get when you get out, and that freaking GI Bill.
Now I'm in finance, and I spend a lot of time helping other veterans, you know, build their wealth and things like that. And there's some structural disadvantages service members have when it comes to that, but then there's some inherent real advantages, and that GI Bill is really like the peak, probably the best benefit that you can get. And that's been true for a long time. We had an entire generation of veterans who came back from World War II, used their GI Bill, and built this country into the greatest economic engine the world's ever seen. So that opportunity has existed for a long time, and people should do it. So, but anyways, the way it relates to me is that I was not eligible because I went to the Naval Academy for 2 years. I was not eligible for the old GI Bill. So I was going to graduate school when I left SEAL Team 1. I'd actually done a disassociated tour for officers. Remember, sometimes like
they'd send us
over to the boat teams.
Right. Mojo went over there.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, 22, yeah. Right?
He went to 22, right?
22, yeah.
Yeah, I went over to SBT 12, Special Boat Team 12. Those are our cousins in the SEAL teams, all part of Naval Special Warfare, the SWCC, Special Warfare Combatant Crewman. Mm-hmm. And so I did an early OIC tour, officer in charge, over at the Special Boat Team. Great tour. Really proud to have done it. Love our SWCC brothers. And it was an awesome experience. So then I went back to SEAL Team 1. Then I was at Group 1. Then I was getting out, and I was going to grad school, and I needed a way to pay for grad school. And I had a friend who was working at a TV network that had just started. And I needed a way.
Female, right?
No, guy. Like, my best friend, Ezra Cooperstein, his, like, my parents' houses touch, but he was like an assistant to the assistant of the president of programming, which in TV speak means, like, you know, he got sushi for the president of programming or whatever.
I got a guy.
Yeah, exactly. But he was also the youngest dude at this network that was targeted towards millennials or whatever. And he's like, you got to meet my friend Kaj. You just got out of the SEAL teams. They needed a correspondent to go to Afghanistan, and he convinced them that I should be their correspondent. I'd never been on TV. Truth be told, like, my parents are, my mom hates when I say this, like, my parents are hippies. I'm a hippie kid from Santa Cruz, right?
Yeah. I grew up under one.
I know, yeah, you know.
Bonafide real one.
I didn't even have a TV growing up, right? Like, for a while, we had a black and white TV. Like, my dad was like 2 decades late to the color TV. Like, TV wasn't part of our thing, like, very, like, literary family. So I had never been on TV. Careful what you deny your children, because, you know, now I'm on TV and I own giant TVs, right? I have like 3 giant TVs, right? So I started doing this correspondent work to pay for graduate school, and I would continue to do it all throughout my time in grad school. So I did, and I was basically, I could only cover what I knew, and the only thing I really knew was national security, so I became a war correspondent. So I did, like, Christmas in Afghanistan, summer in Somalia, spring break Cambodia, and I'd go to all these war zones, and I would make these news documentaries, and that was my start in TV. I like to say I was a SEAL on TV before it was cool to be a SEAL on TV.
You were, man. You were.
Yeah.
Like, we weren't allowed to do that stuff.
We weren't. Right? No, we weren't. And I took a lot of shit. I took a lot of shit from the community, just like you've taken, yep, you know, some shit from the community. And at this point, it's like kind of all water under the bridge because, like, it's like a joke in the special operations community.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
At first, it was tough, but then I was like, wait a minute, that's what freaking team guys do. So
yeah, part and of it. And I stand behind, like, that there are ways to protect our community, but I stand behind what I said earlier, is that, you know, the American public pays a lot of money for the special operations community, and the wisdom that we have, mostly the principles and values, not like the, you know, well, this is how we enter a room shit, like, nobody cares about that, right? But like the stuff that makes the SEAL teams the premier special operations component, certainly the premier special operations maritime component in the world, that knowledge is really valuable in the civilian sector, and I think it's helped shape it.
We used to keep that pretty close to the chest too, man. That's the stuff, that's the pearls, right?
Yeah.
What year was that you...
That was 05. So actually...
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Actually, so talk about, like, I think my toughest moment as a SEAL, honest to God, like, it was probably, like, in June of 2005 when I had just rotated off of active duty, and I thought you got killed, man. And I remember I was at home in Santa Cruz. I've only been out of the teams like a month or two. Life was good. I was like, had a new job in TV, and I was on my way to Harvard, right? I was like, my glide path was up and to the right. Like, it was extraordinary. I was so happy. And then I heard that you got killed. I heard that Axe got killed, and Murph.
James, yeah, Murph.
And James, and like all these dudes that we knew. And like, I just like, it's like when the first time I walked into the museum and saw you guys, like, it still hits me. You know, that thing about like you abandon your brothers, like survivor's guilt. I didn't have survivor's guilt until that moment, until June 28th. And
how about that? That hit guys all the way down the line, even the,
and I had just got out, and here I am, like, living my fucking good life, you know?
I'll let you know how close we are and what that school did to us. Like, you're out and in school, and it happens to all the time when one of our guys dies, and I'm like, why wasn't I there? I'm like, dude, because you're old and you're not in anymore.
Yeah, and you know, look, I know this is your experience or whatever, but that, like, that was the single, at that time, the single greatest loss in naval special warfare history. It was all our brothers. It was fucking Matt's mom was 35 minutes away when that happened. You know, I lost it, you know, and I couldn't get a hold of Morgan or whatever. That was my real survivor's guilt. Like, that was the hardest moment in the teams for me, was 2 months after getting out of the teams.
It's been 20 years.
So how'd you rotate into the business world out of TV?
Oh, yeah.
Because you're still on TV.
Yeah, but TV is not my primary medium anymore. The way I say it is, I did, like, a decade in the military. Because then, so I think, and again, you know, so I go to grad school for 2 years, total break in service. And then right as I was finishing grad school, they stood up the reserves. So then I went into the reserves.
Well, like 17? Did you go
to that? I never did the 17 thing. I was always at a SOCOM. So yeah, I was right, a SOCOM right. Reservist. Yeah, okay. So I like stood up the NSW component of SOC Africa. So that, then I did all my reserve side stuff. So I did like another, you know, decade almost in the teams, but on the reserve side, kind of bouncing back and forth.
Good for you.
Active duty and reserve. So, that was a good experience. So like the way I like, you know, sum it up is I did a decade in the military, a decade in media. Cause I was, you know, full time. I was correspondent at CNN. I was on that.
How was that?
CNN was, it was good.
Because I have buddies over there that I get along with famously, man, but I don't know any of the back work, like behind the scenes back working.
Well, look, it was a different time. I was at CNN in 2011. Yeah. Media was fundamentally different. CNN was fundamentally different. The country was fundamentally different. I still believed in the sort of institution of news. And I to this day, look, I believe that journalism is the fourth estate and can be like a bulwark. Yeah. And that ultimately, like, information matters and truth matters. I think we've seen all of the problems with that media model.
Sure.
Really come to light. But for me, at that time, at that moment, it was a phenomenal experience. I was going around the world telling what I thought was important stories. And then I was eventually went over to this, you know, premium series on HBO, Vice.
Yeah.
And at the time,
great show.
That was the best place to be in media.
Yeah, man, Vice.
Yeah.
Buying a car or a home is a big move, and you want to work with someone that you absolutely trust. That's why I always recommend Navy Federal Credit Union. If you're in the market for a new or used car, or you're looking to refinance, Navy Federal has great rates on auto loans. You can apply online through their app, and in most cases, get a decision in seconds. And if you're ready for a new home, check out their home buyer's choice loan with no down payment options, so you don't have to wait years to save up. What I love most is that they just make everything so simple, fast, and it's all built around their members. Whether you're active duty, a veteran, or you're a part of a military family, at Navy Federal, our members are the mission. You can learn more at NavyFederal.org. Navy Federal is federally insured by the NCUA. Membership is required, equal housing lender. Loans subject to approval and eligibility requirements. Credit collateral subject to approval. Terms and conditions apply. Rates subject to change and are based on creditworthiness. Open to all branches of the armed forces, the DOD, veterans, and their families.
And I could, like, cover any story I wanted anywhere in the world, anything that I thought was important. Like, want to go embed yourself in, like, the guys fighting against Boko Haram? Go for it, right? Like, in fact, Shane Smith, who started Vice when he recruited me away from CNN, he said probably the best thing that any, like, boss could ever tell you, which was, you know, what's the wildest story in the world that you can pick, and how quickly can you go cover it? So that was an unlimited license and charter to do things that I thought mattered. And that's where the waterboarding thing came from. Waterboarding was actually my first big break in TV. It was the first time I was on national TV.
No pun intended.
Yeah, it's like you got to write what you know, right? And like at the time, everybody was like debating whether waterboarding was torture. And there was this huge like debate happening sort of in the annals of national security, but it had leaked out into the public. John McCain was weighing in on it, obviously a seminal voice in this debate. But everybody was talking about it, but nobody had seen it. Well, I had seen it because, and I know Morgan seen it because he was right next to me when I was getting waterboarded. Yeah. And so I had seen it. I had done it. I had had experience. And I thought if we were going to have a healthy, robust debate about a policy around national security that really mattered, and a public debate, that people should at least know what they were talking about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I was in media for a decade. And then during that time, I was, you know, blessed to have a lot of success in media. I've done like all the things there is to do. Like I had, you know, I produced a series on Netflix. I was a correspondent, won a bunch of Emmys, nominated for an Oscar. That was actually for stunt work. I've even done like stuntman work.
That's
like
awesome.
I've made movies, I've made documentaries. So I had this like amazing career in media. And during that time, it was always important concurrently to give back to the community that gave so much to me. All my success in media and then ultimately in money and finance, it all comes back to my roots in the teams. And so I was always working on helping veterans. So at one point, along with one of my other swim buddies from our class, Eric Greitens, who's kind of a infamous SEAL who ultimately became like governor of Missouri and then became not governor of Missouri, but was in our class and him and I started one of the largest veteran organizations in the country, just using our combat pay, like sitting on an old couch like this, and that was called The Mission Continues. That inadvertently helped spawn a lot of other veterans organizations. It became a de facto incubator accelerator for other veterans organizations. So then I sat on the board of Team Rubicon, which you might know has over 60,000.
Yeah, man.
Yep.
Worked with them.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. That's right. I remember when you came
during
on.
Harvey. Yeah.
So I was early on Team Rubicon. In fact, I wrote the first check via Mission Continues to Jake Wood and Will McNulty to start Team Rubicon.
Wow.
And so we helped seed that. And so I was deeply involved in veterans philanthropy. And at some point along the way, I realized that purpose matters for helping veterans and helping the military community. But also purse matters, right? And money matters. And we spend a lot of time in the veteran space, you know, helping guys succeed, right, and getting their mindset right. But it doesn't really matter if we don't get their money right. Like, you know, you could do all the meditation in the world and you come home to $30,000 or $50,000 worth of credit card debt, then it's all going to go out the window. So I got involved with an early stage startup and founded an early stage startup with a fellow Navy intel officer. He was a reserve Navy intel officer who had also spent 20 years on Wall Street. So he was kind of the Wall Street guy. He was the money guy. I was the media guy. We co-founded this organization, kind of looking at this wealth gap with the military. In large ways, the private wealth community has left the military community behind. And in fact, the vast majority of industry out there, if you look around military communities, is predatory. Like, remember, like, I mean, Mojo and I went to jump school at Benning. You went to Benning also, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Back in those days, the Army controlled the jump pipeline. So everybody had to go to basic parachutist school down at Fort Benning, Georgia. And I remember Morgan and I leaving the gates at Benning one time and 0.2 miles off of base, you see the same thing. You see it outside every Army base, but you see
tattoo parlor, used car lot, and a pawn shop.
That's right.
And a strip club.
That's right. An entire ecosystem yeah. of businesses designed yeah. to take military members' money, but there are very few businesses that are actually devoted to wealth building in the military community. And in fact, some of the businesses, like USAA, have actually exited the business. I love USAA. I'm a USAA member. I still got the card in my wallet, but they got out of the investing game, right? And the real truth is the greatest and most consistent way for Americans to build wealth over the last 50 years has been investing in the stock market and at least understanding. So we started this company, which was then called Guild, investing in education platform for the military community to help military people learn how to invest and to invest in public equities. Think about it like a Robin Hood for the military community.
Which is a constant source of income too.
Well, this is what I was talking about structural advantages. The reason the private wealth community has ignored the military community is they thought the account sizes were too small and all this stuff.
But because they're looking at it individually.
That's right. And compared to our socioeconomic peers, right? Like if you're You might not think you have a lot of money if you're an E5 in the military, but you have things like BAH,
you do too,
allowance.
Man. Dental, medical, all that.
Exactly. So you have more discretionary income than your peers, right? And my argument, my thesis was like, if we can just route some of that towards investing, we're going to help grow the wealth of the entire military.
Matter of fact, that's what your paycheck is. Loose spending.
Well, totally. And right. Exactly. So like, and, but look, it does start with education. Like I'll admit, like when we were active duty in the teams, when all we were thinking about was gunslinging. And I 100%. Was just as guilty of it as anybody else.
You didn't right? even want to be home. You just want to be over there doing the thing.
Just over there doing the thing, right? And the idea, look, for you, especially more so than even most frogmen, right? Like, never thought I was going to make it past 35. Like, forget combat. The lifestyle itself is dangerous. The training
Period.
Cycles are dangerous, right?
Period.
I mean,
I think that's why guys went so hard, because they weren't planning on making it. It was like a rite of passage to die before 40.
I mean, I remember coming out to Paycom and visiting you when you saved that guy's life from IADS, you know, who got shot during yeah. IADS. I mean,
Is that
half? The training alone is so dangerous that it's hard to have a mindset of thinking about the future. I think maybe the next generation of frogmen are a little
training
better
would about kill you. Like that one word about war,
right?
Ever. His training is the toughest one, man. Like, hey, man, fucking die, drown, especially for us, man, all the time.
Spring-loaded pilot chutes on your parachute.
You're like,
this is the dumbest design of all time,
man.
Our parachutes, our old freefall parachutes, probably still the same ones today. They had this like spring in them that was supposed to theoretically push the parachute out of the back. If you didn't like. When you're packing your parachute, if you didn't like round this thing, it's like a slinky basically. If you didn't put this slinky in exactly like the right position or whatever, it would like shoot your parachute off 30 degrees or get like snagged up or whatever. So much stuff that could go wrong. It is hard to have a mentality. You're so focused on the 5-meter target. It's hard to be thinking about your future. This is true of young people in general. I think it's even more true in the military. I think it's even more true in the special operations community. So look, I admit that it is an uphill battle. You know, Lieutenant J.G. Larson, you know, did not want to listen to Commander Larson talking about finances for the future. 81%. But it's still a fight worth fighting. And I think you can make a difference on the margins. I think the next generation of military members are more primed to think this way. And there's a set of tools and resources that are available. So essentially me and this Navy Intel finance guy, Intel and operations, we always work hand in glove, right? We did the same thing in our startup in the private sector. We grew that thing, we scaled it, and then ultimately I sold that to a publicly traded company called Siebert, which was started by Muriel Siebert, who is the first woman on the floor of the U.S. Stock Exchange.
Oh, wow.
One woman among 1,300 men. They built her a bathroom out of a telephone booth. So that company, it appreciated the company that I had built, but it also believed in the mission of continuing to serve the military community. So that was great. That was, you know, I did classic frogman style, like full throttle, all in, built the company, sold it, exited. I'm actually still there. When you sell a tech company, traditionally, you do what's called an earnout. So you stay on with the acquiring company for a couple years. And it's almost like you sell somebody your baby. It's theirs now, but you like help them raise it. You should feed it. You should, you know, water it, whatever. I don't have kids. You guys have all the kids. Melody, you tell me what you do. Do you water the babies? No?
Every now and again. You'd be surprised how much attention you got to show them suckers, man.
Yeah.
You think I showed you this a couple years ago. You don't get it?
Right, exactly.
Like, every day.
And the great part is like that company, part of the reason that we sold to that company is that they wanted to continue this mission of serving the military community. So what was called Guild, which was the company I built, is now called Valor, underneath the Valor Initiative, underneath Siebert. And I can, now I do, now that I'm on the other side, I do a lot of angel investing. I help incubate and accelerate companies. I provide a lot of early stage seed capital to companies that that I help strategically. So I'm now more on the investing side, and I continue to educate the military community.
So if a young person that is in the Air Force right now, but they're thinking long term, they're not married or anything, they want to just put a little bit of their paycheck every month into that. Could they do that?
Oh, for sure. In fact, it's actually mandated. And like the number one thing I tell people is so the military retirement system has changed since we were in. It used to be what they call a defined benefit system. Like you did your 20 and got out. And if you did 19 years and 364 days and got out, you got zero, right? But you made it to that 20th year, a kind of like classic, you know, Americana retirement system. It's now a contribution-based system, essentially a 401k that's called the TSP. And the best thing the military does, one of these structural advantages that even though our pay rates aren't that high, that military folks can take advantage of, is the TSP matching contribution. So they'll match up to 5%. So if you're not doing that 5%, you are just leaving free money on the table. And so that's the number one thing that I tell military folks to do, is max out your contribution benefit so you get that government matching. Now, there's lots you can do after that, but that is it shouldn't even be a decision point. That should be automatic for most people.
How much do they have to put in to start an account?
No, it starts automatically.
Oh, like it just
starts. Yeah, it starts. Yeah. And look, finance has changed and finance is changing. It used to be part of the reason military people didn't invest was because stocks are expensive, mm-hmm. right? But I built a fractional share trading app, much like Robinhood, where military people could invest with as little as a dollar. Everybody, even like the E1 living on the aircraft carrier, has got a dollar, right? And you see what these guys buy, Starbucks, right? And I'm not saying don't buy Starbucks. I think you can have your Starbucks and eat it too, right? But you can put a dollar. You can buy a stock with a dollar. And that's a fundamental change in finance that has democratized investing.
We probably drink a third of our paycheck.
For sure, for sure. I do this little fun YouTube series as part of the education stuff that I call Dumb Money. Where I basically go around and ask like service members, like, hey, what's the dumbest thing
you ever? That's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. Because we all got that story.
100%.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially if you're out with your boys.
Yeah. And if they're being honest, like, you know.
So I remember I checked the bank account when we first got out of Buds, and then I put half my paycheck away into an account I couldn't even touch.
Right.
And I never checked it after that to the day I got out. I was wanting to pay for med school. And just half of it, all my per diem, it all went into it, just funneled straight into that account. Or if I got married, she was going to be wearing it on her finger.
Right.
And it was the best thing I ever did. All those kids I tell.
Also the best investment you ever made.
You're looking at there she is right over there.
Yeah.
So nice. I that's what happened to it. That's Navy pay right there. I tell the kids that I send in, I was like, hey man, half, if you don't do half, which you think that's a lot, but when you're in, because everyone thinks about your medical, your dinner, your food. I was like, man, if you're on a team and deploying all the time and going on training trip, they got you.
You just have to take advantage, like actually do that.
Just freaking do it.
A little bit of
discipline. I mean, if someone's so inclined, they should be going after the young military guys because, they don't care what they do with their money. They wind up spending this. I'll never forget this, dude. But when we talk about Benning, this freaking kid came out of the barracks. He's like, $423. Rich man, beers are on me, boys. That's what he said. I'll never forget it. He had that thing above his head. He thought he was the richest damn kid on the planet, man. I was like, $423, man.
That's good money. But like, you know, look, I would also make the argument that, you know, $423 in, I mean, you were at Benning. You must have been at Benning before we graduated Buds, right? So 2000 or whatever?
Yeah, I came back for the L's graduation.
Yeah. Yeah.
After all, I was in the middle of training.
Yeah. You could have bought Apple or Starbucks. You put $423 in Apple or Starbucks, right, Ben? Like, I don't know. Like,
Tesla.
Yeah. Didn't exist. Didn't exist. But yeah.
There's a bunch of stuff that didn't exist back in the
day. And there's so many tools for setting, like you can set it and forget it. But yeah, I think an investment in Apple in 2000 of $500, I don't know what the return is off the top of my head. But
and you could probably make a deal with some of these big tech
well
guys.
Well over 5K.
You know, like, hey, I'm military. Yeah. If I send you some money, can you help me out in there with it?
Yeah.
You know, I'll help fund your company.
Yeah.
I always get a paycheck. So
I love that you do that. Yeah, that is awesome, so man. Cool that you created that.
That money tip thing's pretty good.
Right?
What's dumb?
The bad money or poor money?
Dumb money.
Dumb money.
Dumb money. I actually like, we had to put like a kinder, gentler title on it. It's like military grade mistakes. But no, the truth is, I call it dumb money.
Dumb money, man.
Yeah, dumb money.
Keep it just like that.
Yeah, and it's amazing the number of like guys, like, you know, sometimes you get people who are like, you know, they're like, one guy, you know, he spent it all on like Postmates or whatever. But most guys will tell you like, hey, I spent a lot of time supporting single moms, you know?
100%. Oh, gosh.
Or the hook, he's like, not me, but I know a dude you need to go talk to.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
We had a team at a Lamborghini on the parking lot that said per diem on the license plate.
That is what I'm talking about.
I mean, they're little guys that roll for, you know, team guys and their egos, man. Like we had some rides.
Yeah.
There were some vehicles in the parking lot for sure. Harleys.
The vehicles is a huge part of the problem, right? So like most guys, you know, most or a lot of people don't even understand like the concept of compound interest, right? What Warren Buffett called the eighth wonder of the world. It can be an incredible force for multiplying your wealth, but it can also be incredibly detrimental if you're on the wrong side. So you go talk to these guys, like they have a steady government paycheck. They walk out and they put that $423, you know, onto a car payment for a new Mustang or new Challenger or new Charger, and they don't even know. And I do this all. I poll people all the time in Dumb Money and ask them, you know, what's your interest rate? What's your, you know, APR? Like 22%, right? I mean, it's almost criminal, right? So the first step is education and awareness. Something I believe in deeply. When I built when I originally built the platform, I devoted a third of it just to educating, like how to read your leave and earning statement. Like some people don't even know how to decipher these documents that we get. But you know, part of the thing is like, part of the reason I like, you know, we'll come on podcasts. And here I came because I missed you guys. I haven't seen you in almost a year, you know, 9 months. But you know, is I wanna start this like this first trickle and then like tsunami of focusing on financial literacy and education for the military community.
Because arguably, like the Dave Ramsey of military. Okay, so
where do all the guys in the military need to go to find you to help them out with this?
Yeah, well, look, there's a bunch of things. And I'm not saying that every military person needs to be an entrepreneur, right? I do this podcast called Tactical Wealth, where I talk to other successful entrepreneurs and I bring them on. I ask how they successfully transitioned from military to money. And I'm super proud of that. And I myself was incubated. My company, Guild, was incubated through a incubator accelerator called Version Bravo, which takes 8 Israeli SEAL, Navy SEAL entrepreneurs and 8 U.S. Navy SEAL entrepreneurs and puts them through an accelerator program to teach them entrepreneurship. I was the first successful exit from that program by a publicly traded company, right? And so I focus a lot on entrepreneurship. I focus a lot on strategic mentorship. But that doesn't mean that everybody has to be an entrepreneur, right? Mm-hmm. And the entrepreneurial path is hard. It's like going through buds again. We talk about it all the time. I mean, you guys are incredible entrepreneurs, like, and you've built like an amazing business and an amazing platform. But it's hard, right? People think it's easy. It is a lot of work. And it's not for every veteran to do that. So my primary focus is just on like, it's almost like you got to like first define the target. And like the very first 5-meter target is just awareness, right? Because it's not baked into military culture and it's certainly not baked into military training to focus on your finances.
Yeah. It's not even baked into like high school. Like people just they live off of credit. It's like you get a credit card in the mail at 18 and you're just taught like this is your money now, but people aren't talking about money enough.
I agree with you. I think in some ways the military is a reflection of the greater society. I mean, of course, we're a cross section of society in the military, and like, but I don't know how to impact it at scale.
Yeah,
you know, across the country, it's too big a Mount Everest to climb. But what I can do is like look at this community that we know and love so well, and that has been a part of my whole life. And I would also make the argument that there is nobody more deserving to participate in the like spoils of the American system than those who have worn the cloth of the country.
An actual citizen.
Right.
There's a difference between being a citizen and a civilian, an American, period, 100%.
Yeah.
And they absolutely deserve that.
Yeah. So your podcast, is it on Spotify and all of that?
All the places.
Okay, yeah. YouTube.
Tactical Wealth, YouTube, Spotify, podcast. There might be like a TV component of it downstream that we're talking about right now. But look, it started off as a baby podcast, right? Yeah. Like I feel like you guys, like started small but people seem to be like attracted to this idea of a veteran entrepreneurship and veterapreneurs. And the truth is that this country was helped, like this economic engine, we're the greatest economy the world has ever seen. And a lot of that was built by these veterans who came back from World War II and built the greatest economic engine that the world has ever had. We are still like living downstream of their efforts. So some of the greatest companies were built by veterans. You know, Fred Smith built FedEx. People don't realize, but I rented from Enterprise. This is not a plug. I'm not sponsored by him or anything, but like I rented from Enterprise. Enterprise is named because the founder of Enterprise served on the USS Enterprise.
Oh, wow.
And then he came back and built the car company. There's just all these incredible examples. In next season of Tactical Wealth, I have my friend, you might know him because he's a Texas guy, John Paul DeJorio. You know JP?
Yeah.
You guys
we sure do.
I bet you do.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, damn right I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a hell of an entrepreneur, right? Yeah,
absolutely.
And a great guy.
Great dude, man.
What an amazing human being.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I got to ride with him, man. Yeah, great for guy. I hadn't seen him in a minute, man. But
he's amazing. I'll send him a picture of us.
Tell him JP, I said what's up.
So, yeah. You know, it's so funny. JP, obviously, like this incredible billionaire philanthropist, and like I didn't know JP, but I don't know. Like, you know, like there's a lot of, you know, being a billionaire, like there's lots of sycophants around, and people are always saying good things. There's like a little bit of a halo effect. People are always like attributing things to billionaires, like they're. You know, and look, not all billionaires are great people, but and I was like, this JP guy, like he cannot be as good as everybody says, a good human as everybody says he is. And then you meet him and you're like,
yeah, he is.
Oh man, this guy walks
like
light upon
gave
the
him
earth.
That money because of how good of a dude he is.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. He is the real deal. So, so I'll have JP on next season to tell his extraordinary story from the Navy. To being one of
we can send you a lot of people, actually. I'm going to write down a list of names of people you should have on that are really good.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah, I would love that. And it's been so cool to hear people's stories because there certainly is no singular path, like when you're done with service, especially in the field of entrepreneurship. It's amazing to watch what people do, even in, you know, my Virgin Bravo cohort, which was that incubator that I did. You know, we had me, I built a fintech company and sold it. But, you know, one of my fellow Israeli Navy SEAL cohort guys has this premium sauna company. So he builds all glass saunas. He built one on my house, like right on the river. And it's cool to see the variety. Yeah, and he did it for like health benefits and psychological benefits, and that's his company. Like,
I love that.
My new favorite one's PXG Golf Clubs. Man.
Oh,
yeah,
is that better
Bob Parsons.
Dude.
Yes.
Oh yeah,
Bob that's Parsons.
You definitely got to have him. Reinvented golf.
That's right.
Came out online in the commercials all the way down the line.
Before PXG, he's the one who started GoDaddy, and he's a veteran.
Right.
Yeah.
And a huge patriot. Yeah. An incredible supporter.
So he's another one.
And I'll say, like, even in the SEAL teams, we have a great culture of entrepreneurship, but we didn't talk about it. The only thing that people really knew about SEALs become entrepreneurs, I would say, was like Randy Hetrick, right? Who started TRX. But like, we never talked about this. We didn't talk about like what companies guys
had built. Well,
yeah,
that's because it was in our world.
Right.
We're all in our own insular little world.
So
that's the stuff you don't have to worry about, so we don't even talk about it.
Right. 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 But then guys get out. And I will say now there are some like really extraordinary, these are great public-private sector partnerships and how nonprofits can actually be an incredible force for good.
Yeah, yeah.
You have like the Honor Foundation that's helping mentoring guys into what they do post-service.
I think the first one I heard was going through med school. Had the Asherman chest seal. Rick Asherman, team guy, invented that. And I mean, they were talking
about... We're going to have a bunch of people to send you.
That was a long time ago too, but he was one of the ones I was like, you can get out of what we learned in that school and freaking make some coin when you get out. Just remember what you did. It's not the basic stuff either. It's the stuff you come up with, like on the fly, how to fix something that goes wrong. That's what people I don't want to call it a shortcut because it's not that. It's its own way. But
well, look, the entrepreneurship journey is pretty simple, but you know, special operations guys are actually sort of well positioned to execute on this. When I advise startups these days, I was like, look, all you have to do is apply the scientific method to your startup. You see a problem, like, oh, this chest seal fucking sucks and it doesn't work or whatever, right? And then you have like a hypothesis about, oh, like, I can make a better one, right? Or I can do this thing a better way. And then you go out, and this is the part where like team guys can sometimes be bad entrepreneurs, is you got to like rigorously test your idea, right? You got to receive feedback, right? And not the feedback like from your friends. You have to be dispassionate and scientific analysis, right? Yeah, of course your friends are going to buy your little widget, right? Mm-hmm. Like, but can you really create that like product market fit, like consumer demand? And then harkens back to the earlier part of our conversation. If you're receiving data and it's not working, there's a tendency for team guys to try and run straight through the wall, to just keep
pivot.
Going
yeah.
and grinding. And this is where like startups need to be lean, nimble, flexible, adaptable. These are principles that we teach in the teams, right? Flexible, adaptable, improvise, right? And so that's when you need to like learn how to pivot quickly and to iterate, right? So the idea, you don't want to be so beholden to your original idea and thesis that you get stuck. And that's where I see a lot of special operations startups get stuck. And then ultimately you can scale. Once you have that product market fit, that's when you really start to scale your business. So yeah, that's what I'm doing these days.
You know, I
want us all to share in the spoils of the American system.
Yes.
Absolutely. Feed off each other.
Yeah.
Will you be at the Murph Gala?
I will. I'll be at the Murph. Too. You guys will. Okay. Yeah.
I'll be there.
Yeah. I mean, look, Murph was, you guys know, like we talked about, Murph was probably the first person I met when I showed up to 618 on the compound. And I talked to his dad a lot. I did Murph this morning.
Oh my gosh.
Is it really?
I do Murph every Monday, man.
Oh my gosh.
Murph Mondays, really?
I do Murph Mondays. I do Murph every Mondays. Yeah, like, man, I miss the boys so much.
I love CrossFit.
Yeah.
I'm 2 days a week now. It's basically all I can hold on to.
You just started this summer. Yeah.
Love it, man.
Yeah. I was texting with Greg Glassman because, CrossFit started in Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
Yeah. Santa Cruz is a hub of entrepreneurialism.
That was the first time I ever met you, was at a Murph, like probably 2012, 13, 14, something like that in San Diego.
That's right. I remember that.
I think I was pregnant. And we went out, Mikey Sowers. It was when Forged was,
that's right.
Real big. Yeah.
Yeah. That is right. Yeah. Every Monday I do something to
that's
honor
so
the
cool.
boys. Yeah.
I walk into the CrossFit gym at the box I work out in, and there's a picture of Murph with the Murph workout where I stand in front of every day, and he's always staring at me while I'm getting my ass kicked.
You know, Murph and I used to do it when we were roommates.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was,
that's where I picked it up with him when we were in Afghanistan. Yeah. Doing that workout.
We did it before he classed up, and it was kind of a mod of the old, one of my mentors at the Naval Academy was Stu Smith.
Yep.
And we had the old Stu Smith pyramid, which we used to train for buds. So, yeah, that's
Murph.
It, man.
Everybody I run into always remembers the first time they met him.
Yeah.
That's unique about it. Like, hey, you remember the first time you met somebody? Like,
yeah.
You do remember the first time you ever run across that dude.
Yeah. Just like you remember the first time you did Murph, you're like, holy shit, still sucks.
Still sucks, man.
My gosh. Well, thank you so much for coming out here and for sharing your story. It's incredible.
So good to see you guys.
American Dream story.
Yeah. God bless you, brother.
I love you guys. Thank you.